Blog Talk Radio.
So instead of legislation, in my opinion, it takes education. The whites have to be re-educated so that the racism that they have in their heart can be eliminated, and our people have to be re-educated so that we will know how to do something for ourselves instead of waiting for others to do it for us all the time.
Well, how will that re-education be brought about?
Well, just as in World War II, this country could use its news media to propagandize and make the whole American public love the Germans and the Japanese, rather love the Russians and the Chinese, and hate the Germans and the Japanese. And then after the war, they changed it and made the American public love the Germans and love the Japanese, hate the Russians and hate the Chinese, which shows that they can make the American public love whom they will and hate whom they will. And that same process can be used to re-educate the American public and show white people how to love black people and show black people how to do something to stand on our own feet and solve our own problems.
I'm gonna do what you gonna do.
Black people, what y'all gonna do? Black people, what y'all gonna do? Black people, what y'all gonna do when you wake up and find that you're dead? With maggots and roaches eating the pus out of your prostituted minds and white, dusty hands massaging your hearts with red hot branding irons. They're writing songs of love, but not for me. They're writing songs of love, but not for me. Here we are, the employees of all love, but yet we are working overtime to cover up our loneliness. John Coltrane died in vain of love supreme. John Coltrane died in vain of love supreme. Where are the low staccato screams of black unity? John Coltrane died in vain of love supreme. Where are the higher octaves of righteousness and truth? John Coltrane died in vain of love supreme. Where are the high registers of peace and love? John Coltrane died in vain. What are black people doing enough of that they shouldn't be doing?
Nothing,
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 nothing. Black people, what y'all gonna do? Black people, what y'all gonna do? I see junky bitches giving birth to gonorrhea-faced babies that come out nodding to the rhythm of God Bless America. And these same babies grow up to be good-looking corpses that haunt the streets of Harlem, raping syphilic-minded, roomless black pussies who dream of becoming virgins once again in the hereafter. Stop in the name of love. Stop in the name of love. Stop mugging that old woman. She's been saving her money all year for a trip to the electric circus, but she died the very next day. Oh, God! Oh, God! God ain't dead. He's down at the family planning office, handing out birth control pills to black women, telling them they're a gift from heaven. Look, there's old Sam the wino, searching for a last sip of ancient street love in the empty wine bottles in the gutters of his soul. And the air has become polluted with white lies of love, while love is dying from overdoses of misuse, Christianity, and legitimate insane asylums, and legal torture chambers called White, Southside, Bed-Stuy, and Huff. Are we the black people who once loved with the slow march of time? Time was ours to hold in the soft, love-warm chambers of our hearts. And was we the apple mommies and daddies of a sun world? But turn our stands of hair and two antennas to tune in the juju madness and syncopated love rhythms of Africa. And we love with time, and we took the time to love. And with the right time, we love, and we love time after time. Will we ever love again? Will we ever love again? Will we really ever love again? Or will we just sit and rot away with the brighter tomorrows in the skag field, rat-cluttered, piss-stenched halls of our minds?
Black people, what y'all gonna do? Black people, what y'all gonna do? Will the real black people please stand up?
Yes, yes. Welcome, welcome. My name is Solomon Kamerjian, and welcome to the maiden voyage of the Your World News radio program. It's going to be an exciting voyage, and I hope that we continue to pick up steam. This being the first ever episode of this unique radio show that I hope becomes entirely community-centered. And, you know, this being the maiden voyage, I want to introduce myself. My name is Solomon Kamajan. I'm a community activist. I am political activist. I'm an educator. I'm a proud Pan-African, proud man of African descent, and I'm you know, just trying to follow in the huge footsteps of my ancestors, such as the great Malcolm X, who led our show off. You know, he had the first word, and he was speaking about the role of the media. The media has the ability to propagandize whatever it wants, and unfortunately, this day and age in the United States of America, the mainstream media operates as one of the most anti-democratic forces in America. It's narrowly shaped, narrowly focused. I think that most people listening today and in the future, if you really take a long, hard look at the mainstream media in America and then put it in its proper context when you examine media from different parts of the world, when you look at the alternative media, and then start to do your fact-checking the references, you'll see how narrowly shaped the mainstream media is in the U.S. And it functions as the way it's intended to, and it's supposed to be narrowly shaped that understands critical information, critical issues in a very narrowly shaped manner. And so I think it's the role of progressives, regardless of what their background is, I think it's the role of progressives throughout this country to do what we can do to continue to try to disseminate far and wide, large and small, critical information, critical news to folks who normally wouldn't have access to that news, based on whatever reason. So I'm just trying to follow in the footsteps of my ancestors, looking at folks like David Walker, who had a beautiful piece of literature called The Appeal, where he called upon, you know, people of African ancestry, people who were enslaved at the time, Africans, to take up arms, you know, against their white oppressors, their slaveholders at that time. And so it's time for us, you know, right now to take up mental arms, to take up, you know, non-conventional arms by way of spreading information, because information is power. Information is a method in which, you know, if disseminated properly, if disseminated widely in a democratic way, it has the ability to galvanize and mobilize communities to actually reclaim their communities and reclaim vestiges of power that have been taken from them, you know, centuries ago. And so, you know, I try to follow in the footsteps of John Westworm and Sam Cornish, who are the founders of Freedom's Journal, you know, the first periodical, you know, African-American periodical in this country. Try to follow in the words of the words and the way of the great Marcus Mosiah Garvey and the Negro World, and how that information disseminated throughout the entire world became something of fear for those who were in power, for those Western forces, those European, you know, forces that did not want to see the Negro world. They knew the power of the Negro world. They knew that, you know, in places like Trinidad, you know, the colonial governor there banned the Negro world. And so if you were caught with an issue of the Negro world, you could be imprisoned, you know. And so they understood the as they do today, the power of information. And that's why it's narrowly shaped and narrowly formed. And so what we're going to do, you know, throughout the life of this show, which undoubtedly is going to pick up steam. We look, you know, I say we, because it's not just me, it's you, the listener, who I expect to play an integral role in the life of this radio program by way of calling in. And as you can see, if you're tuned in right now, you can see on the screen the call-in number is 347-945-5191. And once again, that's 347-945-5191. So if you're tuning in now, that's the number that you should keep you know, put it in your phone, save it, write it, put it in your wallet. That's going to continually be the calling number. And so when we're accepting calls, and today, it will be no different. We're going to accept calls probably in the second half hour of this hour-long program. We have an outstanding guest. His name is Maurice Carver. And I thought, you know, we could have, you know, no better guest than to have somebody who embodies progressive black media. And there's a lot of folks out there that embody that. There's a lot of folks out there that, whether it's print or radio or independent, you know, public access television such as Black Men Screaming, they embody progressive black media, progressive independent black media. And so we're going to have him on the show. We're going to have a nice dialogue with him in terms of why he felt the need to start a television show called Black Men Screaming that covers a wide array of topics, which he'll get into, why he felt the need to do that, and try to find out what his successes have been. You know, have there been any failures, hurdles, and you know, where does he see his program as well as black media? Where does he see it heading into the future? And so, a couple of things that people may be scratching their head, maybe saying, "Hey, what's this guy talking about?" Progressive black media. What I mean by progressive black media, I'm talking about media that is not beholden to any so-called political interest party, media that is not beholden certainly to any corporate entity, which is what we see with so much mainstream media. I mean, all mainstream media in this country is basically beholden in some shape, form, or fashion to corporate interest that comes before the interests of the people who are the primary receivers of those messages, you know. So that's what I talk about progressive black media. Progressive black media that puts out issues that have to do about our communities, have to do about our communities in relationship to other communities, and puts out information that has to do with the world in general, and broadening the perspective and the specter of consciousness of its viewers. And so that's progressive black media. But when you look at media in this country, in the United States of America, as of 2009, if you took all the full power television stations in this country, if you took all the full power television stations in the entire U.S. of A, less than 1% of them are owned by people of African descent, so-called African Americans, less than 1% of them. And if you took all of the people of color, blacks, Latinos, Asians, Pacific Islanders, indigenous, put them all together, and less than 4% are owned by all people of color. Radio stations doesn't fare too much better. Less than 4% of all radio stations, less than 4%, I repeat, less than 4% of all radio stations in America are owned by people of African descent. And you know, when you look, put all people of color together, less than 8% are owned by people of color altogether in terms of radio stations. So that's a very serious, very, very, very serious plight that we face, because if other people are controlling the media to that magnitude, I mean, people of color represent 33-34% of the entire population. So it's not even close to being proportionate to the actual population. So if people of other than yourself are controlling the vast array of messages and images that have to do with your community, that have to do with you, that have to do with your community in relationship to other communities, that have to do with government, any of that stuff, you're not going to see a lot of news being disseminated that places things in its proper context for you and your community to understand, so that you can, you know, plan, maneuver around, you know, different issues, so that you can stay informed, so you can, you know, basically just understand things on a ground up level. That's what we're faced with. That's what we're faced with. And so this is non corporate based. It's internet based. It's just a start. I felt that it was my duty to put this together, and at best, I hope that this inspires many of you guys to perhaps start your own radio show, whether it's, you know, commentary based, whether it's news based. This show is going to cover everything from so-called third world news, everything from news, you know, throughout the U.S. And the interesting thing about this is that when we feature certain stories, we're going to try to place them in the in its proper context, or in a very non-mainstream context, in an alternative media type of context, so that we can have a dialogue, we have a discussion, and we can move forward. So, with further ado, because about 5 minutes, we're going to be joined by our special guest, Maurice Carver, who's going to be calling in from Brooklyn, New York. But I wanted to actually feature a news bit by that I acquired from one of the most progressive, not just black, but one of the most progressive media outlets out there right now, and that's a website known as Black Agenda Report, and that's blackagendareport.com. Make sure you make a note of it, blackagendareport.com. That should be a website that you tune into every single week, every single Wednesday, and read the articles, listen to the audio commentary. But a brother by the name of Glenn Ford is the executive director, and he does the radio commentary each week. And it's, you know, it's freely accessible to everybody. You can download it, you can distribute it on your websites, because knowledge is power, and he understands that, and that's why he makes it available. And so what I actually want to do is I want to run with a couple of stories that I think are important for you, the listener, and everybody to know about right now, that are, you know, have not really been picked up by the mainstream media, and definitely have not been picked up by the mainstream media in any kind of proper context. And the first one has to do with the black farmers and what's going on with them, because they're facing a tremendous battle right now. Black farmers are the numbers have been dwindling down to less than 2% of all the farmers in America are black. And you know, decades and decades ago, it was about 14%. But I want you to listen to this right now, and then afterwards, we're going to connect with Maurice Carver. We're going to go to another story. So if you can listen right now.
Some of Barack Obama's chickens and other assorted farm animals are coming home to roost. 6 months into his term as United States Senator, Barack Obama introduced legislation to compensate black farmers for the cruel and blatant discrimination they'd suffered at the hands of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Obama had apparently been moved by the black farmers' claims that federal farm officials had methodically denied them federal monies routinely handed out to white farmers. According to the Washington-based Environmental Working Group, black farmers received only one-third to one-sixth of the federal benefits and subsidies collected by other farmers over more than a 10-year period. Black farmers, as a class, were becoming extinct, partly due to federal government practices. The black farmers sued, forcing the federal government to pay out nearly $1 billion to settle about 16,000 claims. But as many as 65,000 additional farmers had claims that could amount to as much as $4 billion. That's when Senator Obama joined legislation to champion their cause. Congress allocated $100 million with the apparent intention to release more funds later. But it didn't turn out that way, and the black farmers have come to believe that now President Obama is flipping the script on them. Last week, the black farmers and their supporters turned out in force on Capitol Hill, demanding that the Obama administration and the Congress do right by the 94,000 of their fellow tillers of the soil who ultimately filed for claims against the feds. Obama had indeed changed his tune upon becoming president. Now, his administration's position was that the initial $100 million was all the black farmers were going to get. It wasn't a down payment, but a cap, a ceiling. The black farmers felt betrayed. John Boyd, president of the National Black Farmers Association, said Obama's formula wouldn't even pay the lawyers' fees. Many of his members are facing imminent loss of their land. Obama and congressional Democrats urged the black farmers to have patience, but John Boyd replied, "It's too late for that." They didn't tell the banks, the auto companies, and the insurance companies to wait, said Boyd. He continued, right is right, and it doesn't matter who is in the White House. That's when Obama trotted out black Alabama Congressman Archer Davis to take the heat from the black farmers. Congressman Davis, one of the most corporate-friendly members of the Congressional Black Caucus and a protege of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, claimed the $100 million was just a placeholder for monies that would be allocated in due time, that it was not a cap, despite what administration lawyers had said in a legal motion filed in February. The black farmers' patience may be short, but time is in even shorter supply. A little over a century ago, blacks made up 14% of all American farmers. Today, they are less than 1.5%. Congressman Davis tried to reassure the farmers. I know the heart of the president, he said. But Obama's heart doesn't sign any checks. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Yes. So I hope that that might have startled some folks, because I know that there are still a lot of Obamites out there, folks who see, you know, this what I like to consider this illusion of progressive, tangible change in President Barack Obama, simply based on the fact that maybe because he's a brown skin face, and it was one of the best put together media blitzes, you know, campaigns, you know, that we've seen in some time. And it was run just like a full, you know, full-fledged, you know, ad campaign from, brand X, or, you know, whatever industry that that's being pushed out there, you know. But those folks that are still under the spell of Obama, it's important that you all know that the only way that you're really going to see change is if you continue to pressure this individual, because I'm trying to tell you that the people that he surrounded himself with, his advisors from Larry Summer to Bob Rubin to Rahm Emanuel, the list goes on and on. Arne Duncan, this guy who's the new Secretary of Education, this is an absolute joke when you look at what he did to the Chicago school system. He turned 7 to 8 Chicago public schools that were predominantly black and brown into public military schools. And this guy is now the Secretary of Education in the United States of America. But it's important to keep your ears and eyes on this story in terms concerning the black farmer, because they need our support, they need our assistance. So, you know, I really implore all of you guys to get on the web and start to do some research and find out about what's going on, and you know, just pay attention to what's going on, so that you know, they can get the support that they need. And speaking of support, I believe we have on the line right now a good friend of mine, a brother of mine. I look at him as a big brother. His name is Maurice Carver. I mentioned to him, mentioned to you guys before, that he's our special guest for the evening, based on the fact that he embodies everything that we're talking about. We're talking about progressive black media, and he's done something extremely unique in New York City. And, you know, without further ado, I want to introduce him and have him introduce himself. Maurice, are you with us?
I'm right here with you, Solomon.
How you doing, Maurice? Your reputation now precedes you. But I'd like, you know, if you can take a moment to introduce yourself to listeners, who you are, and, you know, just give us kind of like a biographical background of what you represent and Black Men Screaming.
Well, again, my name is Maurice Carver, descendants of the famous Carvers, George Washington Carver, if you never remember that name in this country. And one of the things that I thought, you know, that was very important to me was, you know, family. And part of having this commitment to family was the black family. You know, not just my individual family, but the black family itself. And one of the things that really tremendously hurt me was that I knew that, you know, coming up through all of the hurts and pains that my parents went through, coming from the South and understanding that the sacrifice they made for me to be able to be a successful black man. And then every time I turned around and I looked, I could never find anything that was uplifting or important or that would even encourage me about being a black man. Everything that I could see in the media about black men was such a negative thing, and I didn't experience that because I said I surround myself with people of, that are positive, that are brothers that were out there that were conscious, that were trying to do the right thing. And so part of the commitment that I have also, and I have to, you know, give honors where honors due, is from my father and my mom, who made me promise when I, before I even stepped foot through a college door, to get back involved in the community. So my process was that I started my own nonprofit organization called Stride Incorporated. And basically what we try to do is we try to go back and reach into the community and work with African-American and Latino students who wanted to pursue careers in the areas of math and science. I also came up tutoring kids through the public school system and things. And when I went on to college at Stony Brook University, I ran into a great mentor by the name of Lloyd Sargent, who had an organization called the Saints Organization. And I learned through watching him and the commitment and the love that he had for the black community that combining that with what I've learned from my parents, I decided that we needed to produce something that was going to showcase the experiences of black people that was something on a positive level, especially since it could never be shown within corporate media.
Right.
Now, black men screaming actually comes from, I tell people it comes from love. I mean, the first name is Barry, and that's one of my great friends from college, Barry Vanderpool. The second name is me, Maurice Carver, and the third is another brother by the name of Stephen Green. And we really loved and supported each other, and we just could never understand why they could find the most ignorant person to put on TV, the most misinformed person they could put on TV, and or somebody that they put on TV didn't really represent the interest of the community. So I decided that I needed to form a program, do the use of cable access, and we came up with the name Black Men Screaming, Barry Marie Stephen, Black Men Screaming. And we've been at it for the last 11 years. April 14th of 1998 was our first show. So congratulations on you starting your first show, Solomon. I'm sure that you're going to be around a long time informing the community.
Well, yeah, I mean, I really appreciate that. I mean, it means a lot coming from you because I've had the honor of being on your show a couple times. And for those of you guys who don't know, Maurice Carver does things, you know, and that's a uniqueness. And it's a good segue when we get into corporate sponsorship and, you know, discussing with Maurice a little bit more in depth, you know, what kind of hurdles he's faced in terms of people trying to purchase the show. But out of the love of his heart, I sent him a campaign letter. We're currently trying to raise some money, and we're about to finish the campaign. We're actually less than $1,000 away from completing our $13,000 needed to send 35,000 brand new course-specific books to 5 schools in northern Uganda. And Maurice, you know, he said, hey, you know, come on my show. You know, we have an audience of hundreds of thousands of people in several states. Come on my show. You know, you can talk about the campaign, give your number out, give your information out. And certainly, and sure enough, as soon as my program was over, as soon as the program was over that I was on, Maurice presented us with a check for $100. But then when I got to work the ensuing month or the following Monday, I had phone calls, I had emails of people trying to get my information so that they could send a donation. Some folks sent a donation of $5, some folks sent a donation of $75, and a quarter helps. And so, you know, if it wasn't for Black Men Screaming being a non, you know, corporate based, you know, program, I don't think that would have happened, because I had sent out dozens of letters to all the media affiliates in the immediate area in terms of Washington, D.C., ABC, NBC, CBS, none of them. And it wasn't a surprise to me. It would have been a surprise to me if they got back to me. It wasn't a surprise to me. But Maurice was able to do that because he's not beholden to any corporate interests. And so can you talk about why you're able to, I mean, you said you're 11 years in, why haven't you? I mean, it may be an obvious question, but, you know, for me, you know, because I know you a little bit, but the folks that are listening right now and the folks that are going to listen to this show, you know, after it's archived, you know, don't know you. Why have you not sold out? Have you been presented with any opportunities to actually sell the rights of your program to different entities? And if so, why haven't you literally, you know, sold out?
Well, you know, again, I have to go back to the tree is strongest at the root, and I go back again to my parents. I mean, I look at the things that my mother and my father went through, stuff that people up here don't even in New York understand anymore. Our generation doesn't understand. You know, I read in the book, but it's a different thing to experience and talk to somebody about it. So understanding, you know, how this country can be sometimes, and how this country looks and perceives us as a black man. A black man has a worse reputation than even the devil. So for me, I just said to myself that I wanted to be word, thought, and deed free. Now, of course, obviously, you know, there are expenses that come into producing a show that airs in 6 different cities and, you know, getting information out to people and running a crew and doing this every day. This is a full-time job separate from the other stuff that I do. But again, I mean, it might sound corny or whatever, but it's really about love for my people, brother. It really comes down to that. Now, there was the opportunity for us to make some money, actually more than one time, but it was one that we could have really made some real money, okay?
Right.
Where there were some people that decided from a particular political persuasion, recognized that this particular show was reaching the audience and had a consistent following. So they approached me about, you know, selling the show. And I said straight up, no, I'm not interested in that, because there's some things that are more important than money. I know for most people, they would be losing their mind because they would say to themselves, that's ridiculous. But I didn't start this show because of the monetary consideration. I started it because there was no outlet for brothers to have and sisters to have a place to come and talk about issues that maybe we never will ever hear in the mainstream media. And so, a couple of my friends, you know, some of them are business on the business side, have always been upset at me because we run in a deficit, which is okay because I don't have a problem with that. Because I just want to say a few words also that, you know, it was a pleasure to have you come up and do the stuff that you did with the particular campaign, and I have tremendous respect for you. I don't know if people really know the great brother that Solomon Kamajan is. And so he talks so much about me. I always laugh at that brother because I just try to be an average, everyday brother, but I have tremendous respect for you and all of the things that you do.
I appreciate
and I
it.
Think that people need to recognize that. Solomon has been a friend and a brother to me, and it's very few in all my 11 years, I can on my hand count the real brothers that I met, and Solomon is like one of them, those brothers. But, I believe my business manager has not been happy with me, Solomon. He's like, he could be doing so much better, could be doing so many different things or whatever. And they wanted to turn it into a mouthpiece for the political right. They wanted to turn it into one of these reality type of things. They wanted to turn it into, you know, attack television. I said, no, we don't want anything like that. But also, yeah. I have credit to my crew who loves you to death, Solomon. I have to tell you that. They really do, and we really have a tremendous respect for you on Black Men Screaming. I really want to let everybody out there know that. Because,
and I love
that. Yeah, because you're genuine, brother, and that's a hard thing to find. I mean, you know, like I tell people all the time, and even on the show, I get frustrated sometimes because it seems like nobody is listening sometimes. But when you told me that people were responding there, I said to myself, you know, that is a wonderful thing. And one of the things that I find very interesting about what we do on the show, people would think with the name Black Men Screaming, the majority of my audience is black, and that's actually not true. There's a lot of people that are white that watch, that listen to the show.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, when they started talking to me about my show and trying to get into the particulars of who I am and what I try to do, I really was never really interested in talking about myself. So you got me in a good day today. Because it's not about me, it's about the work. They can put somebody in front of the show, but it's about having that forum. People just don't understand that. We're having a forum for an hour each week for 11 years is a tremendous thing, especially when you look at the media and you don't get the information that you need.
Exactly. Exactly. And I want to talk about, you know, some of the issues that are near and dear to you, because I know, you know, we've had some conversations in the past about issues, because, I mean, I know that, you know, beyond you being a television, you know, producer and host, you're an activist, you're a community activist. And so you being in the belly of the beast, I mean, I refer to the beast as being the U.S., United States of America sometimes, as, you know, we're in the heart of the empire, you know, me being in D.C. and you being in New York City, you've seen some of the worst that this country has to offer for people of color this day and age. And I'm not talking, you know, we're not in 1945, we're not 1935. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, still in 2009, we would still see young black men being killed unwarrantedly by the same forces that are supposed to be put into our communities to protect us. You know, as Karis once says, you know, you were put here to protect us, but who protects us from you? And so this past year, we've seen Adolph Grimes go down. We've seen Oscar Grant. You being in New York, you've seen everything from Amadou Diallo to young brother Stansberry to Sean Bell, you know, last year. So you've seen all kinds of police brutality. I know that you, I recall after the Sean Bell, you were a part of the march, the protest march, and you spent the entire day out there documenting, you know, on video camera what was going on. What are, like, you know, if you could touch on that, like, and the thing is, I don't think people understand, like, the role that the media plays, because the media plays a large role in public policy, because the media perpetuates the stereotype. As you said before, black men are sometimes viewed as worse than the devil, is that the media perpetuates that stereotype, the black boogeyman, and that, you know, when that's put out there, you have young people who are going to be cops one day, and they come from homogenous communities, and they see that over and over again. They see these out of balance, out of whack images of the hypersexual, hyper violent, you know, black man, black boogeyman, and that's supposed to be the representation of all black men. And so when they get that badge and they go into New York City, or they go into Cincinnati, Ohio, or they go into Los Angeles, California, for the first time, you know, having to police areas that are vastly different than their homogenous white communities, when they see a brother coming down the stairs as, you know, as Stansberry, or they see a brother walking out of his apartment building as Amadou Diallo, you know, they like, hey, I'm going to shoot first and ask questions later. These guys are animals. They're animals. You know what I'm saying? So I'm going to shoot. It's like duck hunting season. I'm going to shoot first, ask questions later. What do you think about what's going on, like, in terms of police brutality? Do we live in a post-racial society? I mean, we have a black president. Do we live in a post-racial society? Because I guess some people might think that, because we have a black president that doesn't really focus on a lot of issues that have to do with black people. And I know, and I'll let you talk about that, about what you were really heated about at his last press conference. And I please, I don't want to hear anybody call in and say, you know, I hate hearing this. Oh, he's a black man, but he's the president of the United States of America. He's not the president of black America. And I say, okay, using that argument, I guess black people are not part of America, because he's not really addressing issues that have to do with black America. So yeah, he's the president of the United States of America, but aren't we part of America? So what do you have to say about this post-racial society, and what really pissed you off last week about the 100-day press conference? There's something that got on your skin. What was that?
I there's a lot to answer right there. You know, one of the things that I was listening to the press conference, because as a black man, and I have to tell you, Solomon, I did vote for him, hoping that there was an opportunity for some type of change to happen, especially within our communities of color, because black people, as you know, when the economy has a cold, we have pneumonia.
Right,
in our
right.
Communities, whatever. And so the BET reporter asked a question about unemployment within New York City, you know, 50% of black men are unemployed, and the numbers for underemployed is even higher than that. And so Obama kind of presented the answer that I thought was very generic, of answer, and it really kind of angered me. And so I decided to write a piece on my analysis of his particular answer. And one of the things that I was talking about was a book by Ralph Ellison. It was called The Invisible Man.
Mm.
And I don't know if people have read that book, but it was it really talked about how the experience as a black man coming up in America and how America tries to make you non-existent until it comes to their convenience to use you and then put you back in a place where you started at again. And
right.
So what I said was that when you're dealing with a president who is a president of color, is it really fair to black people to have to sit quietly in the shadows and not speak out and ask for help for issues that are concerning us that are unique within our communities or whatever?
Right.
I said his particularly generic answer is like asking giving an aspirin to a cancer patient.
Right.
So that might be somebody that has a heart attack, but for a cancer patient, you know, you have unique and various needs, and it's not a generic aspirin is not going to get it done. And
yeah.
So I was really angry because I kind of thought that Obama had an opportunity to bring black men out of the shadows of the media, to bring the issues and the problems within that are specifically unique to our communities and address it. Because if I was a Mexican and I was talking to Obama about immigration, he could address that directly without an issue of anybody complaining about anything.
Yeah.
If I was a gay and lesbian and I said I want you to deal with the issue of marriage or whatever, he could address that issue. But as a black person, I'm supposed to be an invisible Negro where I don't have any say about any issues that are affecting my community.
Exactly. And you know, that's a good point you brought up, because if the reporter was Latino, I guarantee, and he asked a question that had to do with something with immigration, I guarantee you he would have answered that question right on, particular to that demographic. And what happened, you know, is we're talking about the media and this, that, and the other, and how it affects public policy. And I want to play something really quickly for you and Maurice, and actually for our listeners. If you can listen really quickly, and on the other side of this 2-minute news piece, I want to get your feedback on this, Maurice. And here it goes.
It appears the racially motivated sentencing laws that treat possession of crack cocaine as 100 times more worthy of punishment than powder cocaine will soon pass into history. It's been 23 years since the Congress was stampeded into passing legislation that mandated 10 years in prison for possession of a mere 50 grams of crack, a cheap and favored high in black communities. Powdered cocaine had long been too expensive for ghetto tastes. To earn 10 years in jail, the predominantly white users of powdered cocaine would have to get caught with 5,000 grams of the stuff, 100 times the weight for 10 years worth of crack. Although the legislation was racist from the moment of its conception, more than half the Congressional Black Caucus voted for it back in 1986. The black lawmakers bought into the hysteria that claimed crack cocaine made previously normal people deadly violent. There's no question that crack was associated with horrific violence, most of it between drug dealers engaged in wars to control the millions in profits generated by crack. But the cases of 94% of the crack offenders in prison today have nothing to do with violence. The crack laws were designed to put massive numbers of blacks behind bars. They were successful in condemning hundreds of thousands of young black men and women to millions of collective years behind bars. 82% of those convicted for crack cocaine in federal court are black. Only 9% are white. Clearly, the crack cocaine laws are models of efficiency in the mass destruction of black lives under color of law. Any civilized court would treat such blatantly race-based mass punishment as a crime against humanity, possibly an element in a broader charge of genocide. The 23-year-long crack dragnet affected every social structure in black America, leaving utter devastation in its wake. The effects of this unrelenting campaign of mass black incarceration, of which crack cocaine was a key component, were so pervasive, the system finally seemed to run out of new black bodies to arrest. This is one of the likely reasons that, in recent years, drug arrest rates for blacks have gone down, while white arrest rates have shot up dramatically. The biggest change came last week when, for the first time, a high-ranking member of the U.S. Justice Department testified in favor of Black Texas Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee's bill that would equalize the penalties for crack and powdered cocaine possession. President Obama supported such a change when he was a candidate. But who is to say that Congress or the states will not tomorrow enact another racially tailored black buck runs amok law? What should be required are racial impact statements that would measure any disparities in the ethnic outcomes of laws enforcement. If impact statements are useful in determining harm to the environment, then surely black folks and other human beings need protection from racist laws and from hate-filled racist lawmakers. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So, Maurice, I know you've had some stories, episodes of your show around these draconian drug laws. We know that the impact, they were called the Rockefeller laws in New York City. And, you know, what's your, you know, visceral feedback from that story that just played?
Well, you know, it's a powerful testimony to truth in media is what it really is. And, you know, unfortunately that, you know, America doesn't want to take a real hard look at itself. If we did, we really would not be offended by that story, but we'd be amazed by the truth that was in it.
Right.
Now, the things that people need to talk about is that when you look at the drug laws or whatever, again, the truth is the number of people it affected and what communities it did affect. Now, the other side to that is that, you know, that I think is very interesting is that we locked all these people up, but now they're coming out of jail.
People
coming out of jail, and besides making furniture and license plates and all of the type of products for corporate America, which you can thank President Clinton for legalizing them using.
Exactly.
Because black people just fell in love with President Clinton, and even he had to acknowledge that he did more things that were harmful to black America than any other president in recent memory.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, and I think that one of the things that I find so distressing about that is that, you know, black consciousness seems to be just a word. It's like if we are asleep at the wheel. I was thinking about the analogy of or the prophecy. You saw the movie The Matrix, right?
Yeah.
And now the Matrix was written by his sister, right, you know, Sophia Stewart, which she actually sued the studios to win that lawsuit. But the thing I thought was very interesting about The Matrix was it talked about a mass group of people that are asleep, okay, and then they have to be awakened. And that really tells the tale of black America, man. We've been asleep at the wheel for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Time for us to wake up because we got too many black brothers and sisters out here that are suffering underneath justice. I mean, if we just talk about the number of people that fought during the 60s that are locked up in jail, you know, those, you know, from Mumia to thousands of other people that go nameless or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still think about a lot of those things. And again, here we go with the media because you might look at some of those people and think that they were terrorists or this and that.
Exactly.
Just remember one thing. If this was the 1700s and we was in England, Washington and all these other people would be a bunch of terrorists too.
Exactly.
So it always is always the issue of what perspective, where you're looking from, okay? Because American quote-unquote patriots, the founding fathers in England were terrorists.
Exactly, okay.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no! I was just gonna say you're exactly right. It's the perspective. It's the perspective, and that's why you need, you know, if you live in a democratic society, you have a media that has representation across the board from all walks of life, all communities, and all perspectives. And that's not what we have here. And so we have a media system that's corporate dominated, that's controlled by very rich elite white folks. And they have no, you know what I'm saying, you know, not just from the Rupert Murdochs, but from the GEs that control NBC, MSNBC. And what, you know, what's funny, what passes as liberal media today, when you look at MSNBC, you know, right. 15, 20 years ago would be considered conservative. But since most Americans have no damn point of reference in terms of what, you know, what truly is progressive media, you know, they look at what's really conservative and think it's and think it's liberal because there's no point of reference. And then, you know, so you have folks that look at this stuff and, you know, even from their understanding about from Cuba and in political prisoners, it's just amazing to me because when you know, like you just said, like you go into 1700s, and these folks that came here, you know, that, you know, were slave owners that, you know, whose ancestors had stolen this country from indigenous, you know, indigenous folks, you know, they were looked at as heroes, you know, as heroes because they took up arms to fight off, you know, the redcoats that were coming in from England. But what's the difference between them taking up arms and fighting off, you know, the redcoats coming that were trying to invade their communities and so forth? What's the difference between that and what the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was doing in their communities with free breakfast programs, medical clinics, and also, you know, willing to take up arms against police brutality when they were trying to come in and rape their women, kill their man, woman, and child? There's no difference. But the perspective of this bullshit media that we have here and this bullshit, like, mainstream educational system, it has them demonizing folks from everyone from Malcolm X to Huey P. Newton. So, I mean, you hit it right on.
Well, I mean, the thing is very interesting, as I said when we had the opportunity to come down to visit you in Maryland, was that the media is very powerful because it has the ability to redefine who your heroes are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about Dr. King, and he's limited to a soundbite. I had a dream. But nobody ever goes down the full length of that message and talk about the check that he talked about that they couldn't be cashed.
Exactly.
That America come back insufficient funds because America hasn't lived up to its promises to Black American and the other minorities within this particular country. Now, I think that, again, when we're dealing with the whole aspect of the prison industrial complex and, you know, a lot of people are asleep at the wheel when it comes to that or whatever, but the majority of these prisons are built in rural communities where these people, this is the livelihood of their communities or whatever, and they're not interested in losing their jobs. So they need more bodies and whatever to continually populate these prisons. And so my argument has been, since we have privatized prisons with Correction Corporation America, Wagon Hut,
yep,
Geo Group, all,
yep,
these different places like that, that are making a profit on Wall Street and imprisoning Black bodies, I certainly have a problem with that. And so my argument was that if they can, as management people, figure a way to imprison us, can't they find a way to keep us out of prison and invest in building up our communities and providing jobs where we can quote unquote become this productive citizen that they've been hoping that we become?
I think you just answered your own question. I think that if they did that, and I think that's why we need media like yours and so many others across this country to, like, galvanize and mobilize and to wake and to be a slap in the face for Black folks, you know, who may have been, like, zombified by mainstream media, to wake them up and so that they can become more active and more civically and politically engaged, is that, you know, when you just pose that question, I think that is counterintuitive to them. I think that if you had a mass populace of poor folks, you know what I'm saying, across the board that are, you know what I'm saying, that are educated and that are, you know what I'm saying, I think that's a direct hit to their base because, number one, now, you know, you lessen the pool of you know what I'm saying, of service workers, and you also, you know, you just mentioned the prison industrial complex, you know, folks like, you know, Wacken Hut, which is now Geo Group, Corrections Corporation of America, they're on the wall, on the stock market. Their stock can plummet if they start to have a mass exodus of bodies, you know what I'm saying, leaving those prisons. And so to some of them, it's very profitable to keep us, like, undereducated because we know that, you know, illiteracy rates, that's one of the main indicators that increases somebody's chance of being incarcerated. And that's why, you know, in some states, instead of putting more money into programs to uplift youth that are reading below grade average, what they do is they take that money and they use it to build juvenile detention centers and prisons during their next cycle. And so they're like, no, young Black man, you know, that's only in third grade, that's reading at the first grade level, we're not going to spend, you know, X amount of dollars on programs to bring you up to grade level in terms of your reading. We're going to build some nice institutions for you that are going to be waiting for you, you know, when you're 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21, when we expect you to be incarcerated. So, I mean, you're exactly right. And people, as we close out, we have about 4 minutes left. All this stuff has been discussed on Maurice Carver's Black Men Screaming program. And I'm going to have him, you know, get, you know, have the next couple minutes to give you guys his contact website where you can get a hold of watching his program, because you can watch his program also online in addition to TV, how you can work to try to get his program onto your public access stations, because it's a unique program, and it's a program that you can become involved in. He allows people to call in. But all these things that we've had discussions around, they've been had on his program, on a television set, and it's amazing. And he's had a wide range of brothers and sisters who have been on his program, talking about everything from issues in the Congo to Haiti to Detroit to wherever. And so, Maurice, can you give whatever information you want to folks to know in terms of how they can start to support your show, how they can view it, all that stuff?
Well, we have a site at www.bmscable.com. That's www.bmscable.com. We air in Brooklyn every Thursday. We air 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., and then at night we air from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. And you can watch that online at www.briconline.org. Okay, and you want to look at channels 34 Time Warner, channel 68 Cablevision. There'll be option 2. You select that, and you'll be able to see the program or whatever. And of course, we air around the country in different areas and stuff. And if you want to reach out to the show, you always can call us at 866-233-3598, option 2, 866-233-3598, option 2. And I just want to say something real quick, Solomon. Something
yeah,
that
go
I was
ahead.
Know. I was driving down the street today, and I don't know if you know that Oprah talked about this KFC thing where they got the free chicken and stuff.
Yes.
And, driving down the street, and there's a traffic jam because all of these black people are trying to get into the KFC and stuff to get this chicken for free. And I thought to myself, I said, you know, damn, if they could just put a message in that chicken, they would bite into it, and maybe they might read something that might open and light their mind. I said, we're so desperate to get a piece of free chicken, but information we won't get out there and get. We won't seek it. We won't try to find out stuff that's going to better our lives, better our children's lives, and empower our community. And so I would encourage you always to pay attention to this particular program that Solomon has launched. I think you're going to be enlightened. I think you're going to be frightened by the things you find out that's going on in this country.
I appreciate that. And that's a good point. I mean, first thing I said is that, yeah, you're right. You know, I never even thought about the kind of scenario that you just placed it in terms of, you know, having a message placed within the chicken and you're right, you know, you have all these folks getting this chicken that's quite frankly genetically modified and engineered. And, you know, in the long term, if you eat in large doses of this chicken, it's the kind of chicken that will kill you. And I'm always, like, skeptical. Why would they be giving away all this chicken? This is all this chicken. Why would they be giving away all this chicken? That raised, like, some question marks to me. But you're right. You know, so the information is here for you. This show is going to go on. Black Men Scream is going to be going. This won't be the last time that Maurice Carver will be on this show. He'll be on many times more. And I just want to close out with a song called Ride the Fence by a great group from Oakland, California called The Coup. Because please, do not ride the fence. Get off the damn fence. Take a side. And as they say on Black Men Screaming, you know, stand up, shout, scream if you have to. Be heard. And don't ride the fence. I'll see you guys next week. Thanks a lot, Maurice Carver, my brother. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Take care. Bless you.
Yeah, that's right. Gotta get off the phone. anti-truck, anti-gun, shit won't buck. Anti-corporate, they anti my evidence, anti-sorting them, anti-depressing, but I'm not pro-popping. I'm pro-bogging and pro-stopping them FBI operatives who professional that black man pound and hand you a sentence that you can't pronounce. I'm also anti-narco, anti-bite, 911 marks the anti-Christ. They anti-social point M6C. Yes, I'm anti the anti-nigga machine. Proletarian, bunkabellic, parliamentarian, pro-revolt, in the 21st century, pro-running up in Congress saying fuck it all. But bring the people with you, that's the protocol. It's been a drug like jailbreak. The whole world is anti-United Snake. So check it out, anticipate the antivenom and move your antibody to this revolution rhythm. We gon' be fucking with them. Pro-union, but most laws they bite. Anti-motherfuckers crossing a strike. Take a look around and be for or against, but you can't do shit if you riding the fence.